Tonight, of course, as usual, the first thought I have when I think about what to talk about in the evening is usually, well, I think of the people who are there and what could be a common denominator, huh, which we can all refer to and relate to. And I thought tonight I start with the themes which we can all relate to, I'm sure. It's the theme of dreams. You all have dreams, when I was a young boy, I must have been maybe around 6 years old or so, maybe 7 years old, I'm not exactly sure, but I was living at the time in a town I grew up, the first 8-9 years in East Germany, and we were living opposite this kind of called a slaughter yard, not a slaughterhouse, a slaughter yard where there was lots of little units where animals were killed for human consumption. And of course, every day the trucks would come down the road and they would stop briefly before they could get into the gate and enter this slaughter yard. And of course, what could be heard was the screams of the animals who were usually they knew what was going to happen. They anticipated that something was coming for them, even though nobody had talked to them. They were just shoved into this car probably and then taken away to this place where their life's going to be ended. And me, being a sensible, or not sensible, sensitive young chap, I must have picked up on this, on these cries and vibes, you could also say, of the animals, because at that age I had this recurring dream. Quite regularly I had the same dream every night. Not every night maybe, but really regularly, again and again and again. Went on for, must have been, I don't know, 2-3 years or so. And the dream was a very simple story. It was me going over there into this yard. In fact, one could go into this yard. When they had finished their work, we could actually go in there as children and play there. We played around there, run around, explored the areas. That's something what kids do. Huh? They're curious what's going on in the neighborhood. And so in the dream, I was going over there across the road into this slaughter yard. And then suddenly, this cow appeared in front of me. It's always this, I don't know if it's always the same cow, but it's always the same scene. A cow appeared in front of me, and then it would open its mouth, and it would be really wide, not just, you know, like a cow when it's mooing here on the field, but really wide, and a big dark mouth, maybe like a size of a hippo, or even bigger than a hippo, you know, big dark space would open up, and I would get really terrified, and then this mouth would come towards me and would swallow me up. And that was the end of the dream. And I would usually wake up in a sweat and be terrified and think, oh, I don't want to go through this again. This is horrible. But it happened again and again. I had this dream of, you know, same scene. Every time, you know, I was going there, it was to play, and this creature would come, cow, usually it was a cow, open up its mouth, this huge mouth, dark, black hole, and swallow me up, and I would be in a terrible fright, terrified. It was, in fact, she, I would say this was a nightmare. And interestingly, then one day, I don't know exactly how it happened, or one evening, when I was lying in bed, I was pondering this, what could be done about this. I was afraid of having this dream again. And then it occurred to me, I said to myself, well, you know, you've been having this experience for quite a while now, and this has been very unpleasant. But really, if you really look at it closely, this experience never really hurt, you know? In fact, once you were swallowed up by this big dark mouth, everything was fine, you know, the dream was over, and you were lying in bed quite comfortably. So I said to myself, well, how if, you know, the next time this cow comes, you just stand there, just let it happen. And interestingly, the next time, I don't know if it was the same night or the next night, this dream occurred. Little Jürgen went out in the slaughter yard. The cow came, opened its huge mouth, and little Jürgen just stood there. And then that was the end of the nightmare. And that was a very interesting thing. It only occurred to me much later that for a small chap like that to, you know, think along those lines and find a way to overcome that terrifying fear, nightmarish fear, it's quite something. Huh? And I don't know why and how this happened. And it must have been some kind of innate wisdom arising out of, I don't know, maybe the pressure of the dukkha, the suffering which I had already experienced, you know, really trying to find an answer to this. This must be resolved. It can't go on like that, you know, every night or every other night or every 3 nights, or even if it's just once a week, it was enough. Go through this terrifying fear. And so this was a, you know, very clear insight, of course, concerning the theme of fear, and of course not only fear, but what resistance does. When one goes into resistance to a particular impression, then you're caught, then you're involved in the story, then you're involved in the scene, and you have to go through the whole conundrum of the feelings, emotions, and terrifying thoughts and so forth which it evokes. So this was very insightful. And of course, this theme especially, in fact, in this story, there's actually two themes in there. One is the theme of fear itself, of course, which is, I think, everybody has to deal with in one's life. And the other is the theme of resistance. Resistance to fear itself, of course. But also you could say resistance in general to anything which is potentially threatening, which doesn't agree with our self-image, which doesn't agree with what we maybe want out of a particular situation in life, we want from a particular person, from a particular situation, how it should evolve, and then we can contract in fear. And fear, actually, you could say in itself, is a strategy of resistance. Whenever we go into fear, there's a resistance there, and we get somehow a little bit blocked, our kind of circumspective or wisdom faculties. Normally, they are very limited when we're in that state. When we're afraid, our whole being just contracts like this, and we get, it makes very extreme, we get paralyzed inwardly, and we're not able to do very much. Of course, on an instinctual level, fear has a very good function, a very healthy function when we go out in the wilderness, and we have to be really sharp, considering some potential danger from wild creatures, wild animals or so, then a healthy sense of fear is a very good signal, It's an alarm signal. We need to really protect ourselves or defend ourselves or do something. But in the human realm, most of the fears, I would say, they're not so much instinctual fears as fears of survival, etc. But there are fears which have to do, which are the result of our whole mental, emotional setup, our conditioning. We all have our particular conditionings, especially early on in life. And I think it's very rare for a young person to avoid experiences of fear and terror. And I think if a small being is lucky, it gets all the support it can get from the immediate environments to help it through this difficult experience, this difficult episode. But sometimes one doesn't. One's just left alone with it, and then still it can resolve itself. Maybe later on in life we have the opportunity to come back to. And very often, of course, in meditation or in other forms of inquiry, self-inquiry, could also be in the psychological sphere, in the therapeutic setting or so. But also in particular meditation, sometimes then fears get evoked, or when we open up, when we have an attitude of really exploring honestly our own inner reality, our being, then of course all these previously suppressed inner parts of ourselves, or things we haven't seen, or things we've always struggled against or tried to control in some way, they surface, they come up. And then of course we are challenged, you could say. I would say we are, in this context, I would say we are positively challenged, because in meditation or introspection, inquiry, we have the opportunity to look at these things closely. You could say we confront them, just like this little boy. In a way, it was a kind of confrontative stance was taken. Okay, but I wasn't standing there like a cowboy, you know, come on, you cow, you know, with colts on my sides, and I'll shoot you. One more step, I'll shoot you. It was more just, it was more kind of a stance of acceptance, you know, just let it happen. It doesn't hurt. Okay, this comes over you just like a warm, dark blanket, huh? And then you dive through it and come out the other side, and nothing has hurt you, nothing has happened. And so we can look at some of our experiences in meditation also that way, what happens when we give up our stance of resistance, right, against anything. Fear is just one example. It's a good example, I think, because we can all relate to it. But take anger, or take any kind of negative emotion like jealousy or envy or compulsive desires or whatever it is, then very often we go into the fear stance. And it could be very automatic and instinctively, or it could be informed by maybe a commentator or a critic which tells us you shouldn't experience this. Meditators have it in the sense of, you know, especially after they've done it for a few years, they get maybe a voice, oh, you should be beyond that. You should have overcome this long time ago. You should have resolved this, you know, way back. Why are you still having this? Why are you still wrestling with this? You haven't made any progress. You're just a failure. Why all this time in meditation, you know, all these years, you know? Where's it all gone? And you're still having fear. You recognize those? I remember there's another story relating to fear which Lompo Somero once told. He was also having a recurring dream, actually, as a monk. It was a slightly different one. And he had the dream that he would go, I think he was in the dream, probably he wasn't dressed as a monk, I could imagine. He would go into a cafe in the afternoon and order himself a nice cup of coffee and a nice piece of pastry, really delicious pastry. You know, just imagine the backdrop of that is he was living a very ascetic, simple lifestyle in Thailand with usually very simple, even horrible food and strong encouragement to stay away from indulgence and enjoyment. Well, very often there wasn't made a difference between indulgence and enjoyment, but that's another story. But he was, in this dream, he was sitting down in his cafe ordering a cup of coffee and this pastry, and then the waiter would come and serve the coffee and the pastry, and immediately as it put down, he was just trying to get his teeth into the pastry, the thought would come up, you shouldn't be here. You should be meditating. You shouldn't be here. You know, this is not, you shouldn't be here in this place, drinking a cup of coffee, enjoying a piece of pastry. And he had, this was also apparently, as he told the story, remember, it was a dream he was recurringly having. That, you know, he was sitting down in this cafe and ordering this thing, and this voice would come and tell, you shouldn't be here, you shouldn't be enjoying yourself in the coffee, you should be meditating hard and be really diligent and get on with your practice. And of course that relates to knowing Lompo Somero's background a little bit, to his, not childhood, but studying years when he was a student. He could be very compulsive about studying, and he would really push himself and just push himself to you know, get the next degree, get the BA and get the MA and so forth, and do nothing else, and just push himself, pushing, 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 learning, 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 reading, 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 and in order, you know, to achieve the goals you're supposed to achieve. And he would never give himself a break, because as soon as he gives himself a break and relax a bit, the voice would come and say, well, you should get your BA, you should get your MA, you should really practice hard and learn and get your work done, otherwise you'll fail. And that somehow, you know, it was years ago, before he was a monk, that had gone, of course, underground, but had still left an imprint in his psyche. And then years later, he was a monk, practicing in a forest, in a simple forest in Thailand, and is living a very fairly ascetic lifestyle, as I said, simple till worse, horrible food, simple accommodation, everything very, very simple. And then these the same mechanisms would come into place, and we'd have this dream and this very pushy, judging voice would come out. So you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be in a dream, you shouldn't be enjoying your cup of coffee and your pastry. And of course, in the practice, relating to the Dharma practice, it would translate into, well, you should always be at it, you know, you should always be meditating, 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 meditating. Don't give yourself a break. Don't relax. Don't give in. Because then, you know, the defilements would come and come over you and take over. So you have to really keep at it, at it, at it, until you reach Nibbana. And of course, not realizing that if you're under this command, and this is kind of automatic command, then in fact, actually, what you actually do, you're moving further away from Nibbana rather than even, you know, into the vicinity of it or close to it. Because you're always operating under this kind of, you could call it, super ego voice. No? Whatever he's doing, you should be practicing more, you should be practicing harder. Or you should be practicing some other method when you're practicing. No? When you're practicing Vipassana, maybe the voice says, you should be practicing more Samatha. When you're practicing Samatha, or you should be practicing more Vipassana. Maybe you should be practicing Jhana rather than just Vipassana. You know, you could have endless variations on the theme, which can come up as meditators, as spiritual practitioners. These voices, what we should be doing. And we can get so lost in it, we don't realize and recognize the voice itself. Huh? And this voice can be very merciless, not particularly compassionate. You know, it's not a very compassionate voice which is well-meaning for our well-being, but rather always grabbing us by the neck. Huh? Okay, come, more, give it more. Huh? Not enough. It's never enough. When you listen to that voice, it will never be enough. It will be not enough till the end of your days, until the day you die. It will not be enough. You will probably, on your deathbed, you will have the voice come, oh, you should be more relaxed in the face of death or something like that. Why are you so, you know, why are you resisting what's coming up? So it's better not to wait till the day one dies, I suggest, to the last or last days. Also then, we can't really trust that our faculties will be intact enough to look at such issues, but better to look at now and see, well, where is there any shoulds in our lives? And also, where is resistance in any of its myriad forms manifesting in our lives too? And this, of course, needs a little bit of fine-tuning and a little bit of careful looking and sensing and listening to the messages we get from the mind. It might be still one of the more, maybe, for some of us, easier ways of looking at it. But it could be also more subtle notions which have not a voice. You know, they don't have verbal messages. It might be just some kind of a sense, a feeling, a subtle feeling, a restlessness, an itchiness we have, and we don't really, can't relax, and we can't feel at ease, where this mechanism is coming in, and is tormenting us, doesn't let us really be at peace with the way things are. I remember one meditation teacher I know, when he'd given his retreat, he put a little banner over the entrance door. It was kind of the motto of the retreat. And the motto said, "Resistance is futile." That was the motto of the retreat, "Resistance is futile." It's quite nice. Futile. In vain. Huh? Pointless. You know, if you put it like that, you know, it's a nice reminder. It goes in, you know, okay, this is the theme. So if resistance is futile, then the first question, of course, you ask yourself, well, do I have resistance? And how do I recognize it? You know, where does it manifest? Is it detectable? Is it difficult to detect or is it easy to detect? And I can say from my own experience that resistance has many, many, many forms. And it keeps on coming. It keeps on coming in the spiritual life. Of course, as we go on, as we're getting older and maybe a little bit more refined in our observations, the strategies of resistance are more subtle. They're not so obvious. It's not a kind of outright no or scream or so. Mm-hmm. The screams will get more gentle and go more into the subtle realm where we resist and we find ourselves in a stance of non-acceptance. That's putting it a little bit mildly, non-acceptance. And if we're looking at our experience, we can see very often that we're inwardly struggling. We're asking ourselves, why is this? I don't want it like that. I don't like it like that. I had it rather any other way. I have other plans. I've had other plans. And now I have this. You know, I have this thought. I have this feeling. I have this experience. And it's very pertinent. Huh? Very pertinent. And I think we're only motivated to really do something about it when we also acknowledge that this really makes us, in the long run, it makes us unhappy. It gives us, doesn't let us rest, doesn't let us relax, doesn't let us come to an end of the feeling of discontent and ill at ease which this stance provides for us. So that's why a lot of very basic instructions also in meditation, in the spiritual life, tries to teach us to accept, or as we say in Buddhism, to see things as they are. It sounds very much like a truism to see things as they are. Well, yeah, so what? You could say, see things as they are. But very often, if we're looking a little bit closely, say, well, yes, do we actually do this? Do we really see things as they are? Or listen to things as they are? Or feel things as they are? Or is there something wedging itself in between and really not making it possible to see things as they are, or accept things as they are, allow things as they are? So this, sometimes the encouragement I find very good advice is to allow things as they are. From the great things, the big things, the bigger things of our lives, the bigger upsets, to the small things, everything is to be included. But of course, we start to practice with the small things. We don't, as I like to say, usually we don't like to learn sailing in a storm, in a hurricane. We like to learn sailing when the sea is calmer, a little bit of wind, and can you learn and pick up your skills. Recently, a woman who was a nun, she's disrobed now, she's been a nun for a long time, more than 20 years. She disrobed a few months ago, and she wrote to me that, well, I knew that she had been diagnosed with cancer last year, with bone cancer, and had to make a very difficult decision, went through quite a lot of difficult decision making what to do, and eventually she made a decision to have her lower leg amputated. And, you know, so she had to work with that. And then in the process, while she was still in the process and after the operation and so forth, she recognized and realized that her father was going increasingly dement, slipping into dementia. And her mother got more and more overwhelmed by the burden of looking after her father. And a few other things, and this contributed eventually to her decision to actually leave the nun's life and to become a layperson again and support her family. And hardly had she left the nun's life and decided to stay with her family, then her mother complained about headaches in the mornings, successive mornings. So she had an investigation, and it was found out that her mother had lymphatic cancer. Well, can you imagine? Can you imagine this happening? This would be learning sailing in a storm, if you wait for challenges like that. Could you hear the no against the universe, the big loud no? No! Stop! Give me a break! Not more of that. But she didn't, actually. She is a very inspiring example how she, not only how she dealt with her own illness and the challenges this provided for her, but also successively with the situation in her family. And of course, it's a proof that she's been making preparation whilst the sea was still fairly calm. She's learned how to deal with these big challenges, she could just get in touch with the movements in her own mind and her own heart and learn to not say no against that, to provide a space, a conscious, aware space for the little challenges, which is in the domain of our feelings, emotions, and thoughts, which come and go every day, by the hundreds, by the thousands. And that's certainly, this is certainly my interpretation of it, that has helped her and paved the way, provided her with the equipment. She's so well equipped. So that even now with a challenge of that magnitude, she's not blown over. She's not going under. She's taking it as it comes. And interestingly, she takes it now that the cancer of her mother is another confirmation that to disrobe was the right decision. So now she can be there and give full-time attention, full-time support to her family. This is obviously what should be doing. I think in this context, the should has its place. Look after our families is one of our fundamental duties. One of our family members are in need of our help and support. So these are, kind of thoughts to ponder as we go through life, and life is still fairly normal going, maybe even easy going, and to concern ourselves with maybe the subject, resistances, aversions coming up. Of course, this belongs to the whole, if you want to talk about it more in a structural sense, belongs to the group of negativity, aversions, the dosa aspect in Buddhism, we call it dosa, based on aversion right up to hatred. And so on, of course, the teachings say, we have to come to terms with dosa, and we have to come also to terms with raga, with wanting, with desire. And usually these are in a very flowing interplay with each other, the desire strategies and the aversion strategies. I want something which I don't have. That's desire. I want to hold on to some experience or inner state which is lovely, which I can't let go. That's desire. And then on the other side of the spectrum is the resistance. I don't want that. Which is very often, it's ironic. It's already on our doorstep and we're still in resistance. It's already here. I'm already experiencing it. And I'm still in resistance, isn't it? And it shows how far our understanding can take us. Even if we understand it, we understand the mechanism, maybe intellectually, we can have a, you know, and that's not very, very difficult to understand the mechanism intellectually. You know? Teachings on dosa, on raga, on aversion and desire, compulsive desire, they're very clear, it's very obvious, also to detect it. But then the decisive aspect to deal with these things is how we meet it when it, as soon as it occurs, the moment it occurs, that's the decisive moment. So that's why we train ourselves in the Buddhist tradition, in our tradition, and I think in other traditions as well, we train ourselves to be ready for that, to increase the willingness to be ready for that, and to develop the skill also to be ready for that. Because if we don't have any skill, then we will shy away from the challenges which are there to come. We'll rather distract ourselves or deny that something is happening. You know, denial is a very good strategy also. Deny that something is of importance which actually is. You deny something which is already there. We can do that too. Huh? We can deny. It's another form of resistance to deny, to live in denial. Some people live in denial most of the time. Some people live in denial all of the time. It's possible. But when one is concerned about waking up, and the Buddhist tradition is repeatedly, of course, talk about waking up, we don't want to even live part-time in denial. We don't want to live part-time in resistance, in refusing to acknowledge what is our task. And our task is always to meet the present moment, you could say it very simply, to meet the present moment as it is, without any commentary, without any resistance, without any but, without any stop, give me a break, without any additional commentary at all, or sub-commentary. Just see it like this. It's like this. This is a very recurring mantra which our teacher Ajahn Sumedho has hammered down on our heads for years. It's like this. His teachings seem to be getting very much, much more simpler as the years went by. Or the mottos, you could say, were much more poignant and simpler as the years went by. One of his favorite mottos was, it's like this. It's like this. It's just like this. Well, Ajahn Chah used to say, just that much. It's also another little pointer, you could say. Just that much. Just that much attention to this. And it's like this is, of course, if we can say this to ourselves, and not just as a mantra, a mechanical mantra, but we can say it to ourselves when we experience something which we don't like, we can say, it's like this. That moment acceptance happens. That moment the heart softens a bit, it opens a bit, there's a bit space for it in the inside of ourselves. And the light of awareness goes on. The attention goes to this particular phenomenon. And then, of course, it can leave us. It dissolves. Because nothing can really stay or, you could say, build a nest in our consciousness, in our hearts, which has the full light of awareness shone onto it. It can only do it if we don't notice it. We deny it or we don't want to see it. It's in the darkness, in the dark corner of our citta, of our heart, there can build a nest. And it can create the impression that it belongs to us. You know? It's something, you know, which I am, or at least which I possess, or maybe the other way around, which possesses me, could also say. You know? It's a various way of looking at it. And so that's why these little pointers can be very helpful to remind us. It's like this. Don't have to say it very strongly. Simply like this. Okay. So what does it do? It can lead us into an inquiry. Huh? What were the conditions to bring this about? What are the conditions, the good and benevolent conditions, so that it can go? What inner attitude, what inner way of relating to it? Huh? So that, it's like this, it doesn't become a dogma. As I said, it shouldn't become mechanical. Rotten Tomato says it's like this. Okay, it's like this. Why doesn't it go now? Because it won't. Because we haven't really inquired. Huh? So we need to have this element of inquiry into it. It's like this. And what comes next? What comes after it's like this? What's the next moment? Huh? Are we expecting some miracle to happen and things go the way we want them to go? Or experiences to only be agreeable to us, to be under our control, that we can say, I only want that, experience that what I like, and I don't want to experience that what I dislike. Well, yes, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? But life is not like that, isn't it? Life is not up to our under our control. It's not up to us picking and choosing, really. You know, what's coming up next in our mind or in our heart, we can't choose that. Things just come, doesn't it? Stuff just happens. And we can't control it. And I would even suggest we shouldn't control it. But we should rather use wisdom and mindfulness. Should. Watch the should. Should use mindfulness and wisdom to relate to it. Inquiry. Presence. Eh? The word presence also implies that aspect of it's like this. If I'm present, I'm saying first, it's like this. I'm not saying it should be, it shouldn't be like this. It should be different. It should be how I want it, how I like it, how I need it. So, I think you get the message. I'm just repeating myself tonight, so letting you ponder this further. Just a little theme, but I think an important theme, though the way we relate to our inner world, our inner experience. And I hope that you, some of that will be a seed in your own mind, in your own heart, to explore this a little bit further for yourself. So I offer this tonight for your contemplation.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.